Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Fiction, science fiction, horror, fantasy, crime, LGBT, thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on KCBA 106.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 1050 AM Palm Springs.
And so I want to bring in John Ferrick. Thank you for being here, John.
Thanks for the opportunity to be back on the show again, Alan.
Oh, it's always good to have you on. And so now this book you wrote, it's called The Wrecking Crew, and it's demolishing the case against Steve Avery. And you've had full access with Kathleen Zellner, who's the attorney that's representing Avery, and she's also the one kind of known for wrongful convictions and getting them overturned. So that's fascinating. What a good setup. And I'm happy for him. Now, tell us how you got involved with Kathleen Zellner.
I was up in, at that point in time, I was up in Wisconsin. I was working out of Appleton with the USA Today Network, which is part of the Gannett newspaper family. And I worked on the statewide investigative team. So pretty much every story or project that I was involved in was published in all of Gannett's Wisconsin daily newspapers, and they had 10 or 11 at that point in time. But because of the magnitude, the interest nationally and internationally in the Steve Avery case, a lot of the stories that I wrote then were also appearing in the USA Today and at our other properties throughout the country. I mean, it was not uncommon for me to have, you know, one of my stories on the case in the Indianapolis Star or the Arizona Republic, some of the other big properties. But again, it just kind of fell into play. After Making a Murderer came out, there was, as your listeners may remember, there was a national, just unbelievable heightened interest in this case that people in Wisconsin knew and remembered, but a lot of people around the country and the world really, for the first time, this was their first taste, their first opportunity to learn about this case. And so because of this unbelievable interest in this case, my editor basically gave me permission to, you know, write as often and as much and extensively as I wanted about the Steve Avery case. And he was also very aggressive and basically had no issues, no problems as far as if I wanted to dig into corruption or allegations of, wrongdoing, you know, in this case, involving some of the police officials that were responsible for the convictions for Steve Avery and Brendan Dassey to a degree, too.
Yeah, that's quite the undertaking, because that was a massive, massive media boom when Making a Murderer caught on the first time on Netflix. There were so many groups and so many shows and so much talk, and it was almost like the election. You know, it was phenomenal.
Right, and so you had a situation where I go into these stories very competitive, and I want to be able to produce the highest quality as often as possible, try to have exclusive stories and give people new information and worthwhile information that they aren't getting from other sources, other news outlets. But at the same token, too, I realize when you have 10, 15, 20, you know, two dozen other legitimate news organizations also fighting for the same story and trying to find a different angle, you're not going to be able to beat every single one of them. But what I realized is that it was kind of like a race, but this was really a marathon. But at the beginning, it seemed like everybody was in the 100-yard dash mode. So everybody just kind of, you know, ran out of the gate to try to get as many stories as they could about the Stephen Avery case. But after about 3 weeks, probably half those news organizations stopped covering the case as consistently and religiously as I was covering the case. And after another 3 more weeks, so you're about 6 weeks out, another half of those kind of moved on or lost interest or didn't have it. And I try to do my best to consistently try to produce at least one in-depth investigative story a week. Sometimes I had several, but I was trying to make sure that we were providing consistent and regular coverage about the case in wake of Making a Murderer coming out, and with Kathleen Zellner announcing within about 2 or 3 weeks of Making a Murderer coming out that she was going to become his lawyer and do it for free. And that was a key point that she wanted to stress, that this wasn't something that she was in for, you know, for money. Quite the opposite. She was dedicating her law firm and her legal services for free to try to prove that Stephen Avery was innocent.
That must have been quite a surprise for a lot of people, like Avery himself and others. It was a little bit for me, not that she would do it for free, because she does this sort of thing, she's that type of person, just that she would take on the case. How do you think that made people feel?
Well, I would say that people that believed in Steve Avery, they could not have been any happier, given Kathleen Zellner's track record and numerous successes throughout the country, whether that's the Ryan Ferguson case in Missouri or here in Illinois, even with the Kevin Fox case, which, you know, has gotten a lot of national attention, to some other wrongful conviction murder cases out of Chicago and Indiana that she was involved in as well. So, you couldn't have, as far as if you're a supporter, you know, or somebody that's wants to see Steve Avery vindicated and exonerated, you couldn't have the stars align any better, so to speak, Al, than to have Kathleen Zellner, you know, drop in out of nowhere and be willing to not just take the case, but to be willing then to put in the time, the effort, you know, and hundreds, if not thousands of hours, actually, to try to prove that the 2007 trial was all a sham, and that the evidence, although it was forensic evidence and on the face, it's damning evidence, but she's been able to work to try to show one piece of evidence by one piece of evidence. Here's why they're false pieces of evidence, and here's how they were manipulated in order to get Steve Avery convicted in 2007.
Yeah, she has quite a very, I like her system. She's very thorough. I like watching her on Making a Murderer too. And I like that she's not real jumpy at things. Like things come across the desk, something comes across, and she analyzes it, takes her time, and then works it out. It's not like this quick, you know, jump to things. She's very thorough, and I think that's excellent. I mean, I take my hat off to her, but you know, I'm
not right.
Yeah, so she's fantastic. Now, when did you get a chance to meet her?
I would say, I'm trying to think, going back in this case, I think probably the first time I had an opportunity to probably see her, meet her face to face, do those kinds of interviews in person was probably in the late summer of 2016. And I think actually, for listeners that have watched part two of Making Murder, I think that might be around episode four. You'll see a big crowd of journalists, and I'm in there, but we were all in Manitowoc at the Manitowoc County Courthouse waiting for her first time that she was going to make a major filing in the post-conviction case for Steve Avery. So it was August of 2016. And she showed up it's either Thursday or Friday. But anyway, we were all there at the courthouse in Manitowoc waiting for her. And then after she filed about 1,200 pages of post-conviction material, then we all gathered at the top of the steps, concrete steps at the courthouse there, and did a press conference interview with her. And I know I had a chance to ask at least two or three questions at that point in time. So that was probably my first real face-to-face interaction with her. And then over the next two plus years or so then, I continued to do a lot of in-depth stories analyzing her filing and also the case against Steve Avery. Then I left Gannett and came back to Illinois and took a new job in online journalism back in my hometown area of Joliet. But I decided I was going to try to pursue this case as a book just because I thought that at some point in time there was enough material here to put together a book that was unique, that really hadn't been written about Steve Avery before. And as we both know, there's been at least probably, a half a dozen different books about the Steve Avery case. Most of those books, not all, but most of those books, were written from the standpoint of pro-prosecution. That Steve Avery is guilty, the evidence is there, it's an open and shut case. But I wanted to try to put together a book, Al, from a unique perspective, and I thought chronicling it from the effort of Kathleen Zellner and her strategy and how she tackles and dissects each piece of evidence one at a time and how she came up with her various conclusions, I decided that was going to be the best angle that I thought could be worthwhile and informative for people that that may be totally immersed with Making a Murder, as far as that they've watched all the episodes multiple times. They spent a lot of time on Reddit dissecting the case files, the police reports, that sort of stuff. But also for the novices, people that really aren't that, don't have the time to do that type of stuff, but know the case, but want to learn a lot more. I really wanted this book to be for those kinds of people, Ben L.
And so you do take the evidence. It's very evidentiary that people have the evidence and kind of explain to people why Ms. Zellner doesn't like a piece of evidence and what her opinion of it. So you're kind of giving them a good rundown in the book.
Thank you. I figured the best approach from the book standpoint was to try to separate as many of those pieces of evidence and kind of give them their due diligence, so to speak. That way people can really kind of hone in on one piece of evidence in a given chapter, and then another piece of evidence in a different chapter, and another piece of evidence in a different chapter. Whether we like it or not, this particular case against Steve Avery is really about forensic science. And that's what I have to work with. That's what Zellner has to work with. So to do that in this fashion, I really had to write this book from a standpoint of more analytical, more relying on court documents and filings and briefs than in some of my other books where I probably spent a lot more time just knocking on doors or doing phone interviews with people and stuff like that. This book needed to be as precise as possible because, again, we're dealing with forensic science, and scientific evidence here.
So now, what do you find out of all the evidence you heard, what was the most surprising to you? Like, we've all heard a lot about the different evidence, and, you know, of course, you being on the case and all that sort of stuff, and following it throughout in writing. Was there anything that came up through Kathleen Zellner that just totally blew you away?
I would say yes, and it would be the two. There were two DNA swabs. If just to refresh our listeners here, after Making Murder came out, one of the big criticisms from the Steve Avery's Guilty faction and from Ken Kratz, who was pretty much the main spokesperson or loudmouth as far as telling everybody that Making a Murder was terrible and wrong, even though it wasn't, but he was saying, oh, they left out evidence, and they didn't spend enough time in the original Making a Murder focused on the fact that Steve Avery's DNA was found underneath the hood latch of Teresa Halbach's vehicle. Well, Zellner spent an inordinate amount of time this time around trying to figure out how Steve Avery's DNA could show up, on an item, on a swab of evidence. And it turns out she was able to uncover some unbelievable research on this case, and she basically has been able to determine that in all likelihood, Mark Wiegert from the Calumet County Sheriff's Office and Tom Fassbender, the Wisconsin DCI agent, that were the two lead investigators on the case, that really were in it to make sure Steve Avery was found guilty and that he was really the only person seriously looked at in the case. But it turns out that there were two additional groin swabs that were taken from Steve Avery at the time that he was arrested. And the amount, the science, this is where the scientific evidence is really important for the listeners. The amount, the quantity of DNA that was found on the so-called DNA swab that was taken from the hood latch was an incredible amount of times. And I have it in the book, but I just can't remember off the top of my head here, Al. But just it was an incredible amount, a monstrous amount of DNA was found on these swabs, which basically left Zellner and her scientific experts convinced that the swab that was taken from the vehicle absolutely could not have been the swab that was from Steve Avery, that basically somebody substituted some additional swabs, and in all likelihood it came from these two groin swabs. And I have experience with this kind of nonsense, and monkey business in the past. This was the same type of behavior, misconduct, that happened in the case that I wrote my first book on, Bloody Lies, the CSI scandal in the Heartland, with Dave Kofod, the CSI director out of Omaha. He ultimately went to prison for planting evidence in high-profile crime cases. But what did him in, what the FBI and the special prosecutor were ultimately able to determine and prove, was that he was substituting swabs, pieces of evidence with DNA with blood on it, from other swabs that he had already collected earlier. And that's the way that most people plant evidence, is that that they already have the evidence collected and then they just substitute it, for some other piece of evidence. And that's how the planting and the fabrication of evidence occurs, Danielle.
So in this particular case, when you say the planting of the evidence and the substitutions, what is the main reason that all of that effort to plant evidence went on? Like, logically, what was the reasoning behind keeping Steve Avery in jail?
Well, I would say at that point in time, where the so-called DNA evidence from the hood latch occurred was actually 6 months after he was arrested. And it was suspicious to begin with because the car, Teresa Halbach's RAV4, had already been impounded and taken into custody. And it had undergone an extensive analysis by the state of Wisconsin crime lab. And they didn't find any any additional evidence pointing to Steve Avery from that vehicle, except for the blood in the car, that which was believed to be planted from the get-go and stuff like that. But the reason why something like this would occur months later is because the prosecution would be trying to shore up, holes in their case and to make sure that they had an ironclad case when they went to trial. So they did have some evidence that they felt, was off to a good start. But these were things to solidify the case and the follow-up on their arrest that they had just made about a month earlier of Brendan Dassey, as listeners may recall. And right around that time frame, too, Dean Strang and Jerry Buting had come onto the case. So people sometimes often forget this, but Buting and Strang only got involved in the case in February of 2006. Avery was arrested in November of 2005. So, again, you're talking almost 4 months later. And for the prosecution, the fact that Strang and Buting, who were two very good lawyers and had a, you know, good reputation, the fact that they were now coming on the case as opposed to Avery having public defenders would have scared the prosecution, you know, and the police somewhat because they knew that they were going up against formidable defense lawyers. So it's not that surprising, given that context of the facts, that additional pieces of evidence might be manipulated to even further shore up the case against Avery and or Brenda Dassey.
Yeah, some of the interesting pieces of evidence, like the shotgun shell in the garage and how they're mentioning that it was chapstick, how the chapstick went missing, and that's how Teresa Halbach's DNA would have been found on that. Now, something like that tends to get a little bit of a reaction up, like that's pushing it. It's kind of that's fantasy. What's your thought on that particular piece of evidence?
In my mind, that seems to be another good example. If you look back at it from a chronology standpoint, for whatever reason, you know, the Calumet County Sheriff's Office was, I would say, obsessed with obtaining some of these odd items of evidence in the very, very early stages of the case, you know, from Teresa's bedroom and stuff like that. And if you look back at it now, you know, and make that connection, you could see the possibility that they were trying to obtain items of DNA, you know, that at some point, at a later point in time, could possibly be used, you know, for evidence manipulation purposes. Why in the first couple days she's disappeared? It that's just not common behavior. I can tell you from investigating other, you know, writing about numerous other missing persons cases and homicide cases that you would have a person disappearing, you know, on a Monday and by Wednesday or Thursday, the police are going through that person's bedroom, you know, trying to scoop up as many of their combs and hairbrushes and, you know, lipstick, moisturizers, you know, and that type of material. And even in this case, I mean, believe it or not, it's a fact. I mean, one of the items they also took was Teresa Halbach's, you know, sexual vibrator. So, I mean, again, these are in the first couple days of the case. Again, looking back in the case now and knowing the pieces of evidence and knowing a lot of the suspicion about them, you know, one can only wonder if these items were being taken and collected, like I said, for the possibility of manipulating other pieces of evidence at a later point in time so that they would come back and connect back to Teresa Halbach as far as being able to tie her to Stephen Avery as and Brendan Dassey as her killer.
Yeah, so now on the idea of planted evidence and the suggestion that, you know, perhaps the cops were doing it, what do you think the key piece of evidence that sold the jury on convicting Avery is?
The key piece of evidence? Yeah. Well, I would say probably one of the major items was probably the bullet fragment that was conveyed to the jury that it contained Teresa Halbach's DNA on it. And again, that was another one of those very, very, very fishy items of evidence because, the Manitowoc County Sheriff's Office had overseen and led the original searches of Avery's garage, his detached garage over near his red trailer. And they spent two or three days in there during the initial November 2005 search, and they really went through that garage meticulously. They find zero evidence, no blood, no bullets, along these lines. Nothing really that connected Mr. Avery to Ms. Hallbeck's homicide. And so that was kind of over and done with. And it really wasn't until 3 or 4 months later, the late February, early March timing where Brenda Dassey was then pulled into the case and interviewed and pretty much gave that false confession. But it was around that time that they decided, whoa, let's go back inside the garage. And it was only during that follow-up search 4 months later, again, after no evidence was found in the garage, when they really tried hard back in November to solve the case. And this time around, this additional bullet fragments, I think there was a couple of them, but these all of a sudden showed up out of nowhere. And then it was conveyed at a later point in time when the case went to the trial that these bullet fragments had contained Teresa Hallbeck's DNA on them. So I think that was an important piece of evidence for the prosecution, for Mr. Kratz to sell the case to the jury. And again, it's just very suspicious, the whole circumstances, as far as you try really, really, really hard, when the case is brand new, when it's fresh, and you find no evidence in the garage. And then all of a sudden, 4 months later, you decide, well, maybe we missed some stuff in the garage. They basically gave themselves an opportunity to do like two or three do-overs. And it was just like the same circumstance with, as people remember from Making a Murder Part 1, with Andy Colburn and Jim Link finding the spare key on Avery's bedroom carpet during their seventh or eighth search of Stephen Avery's bedroom.
Yeah, and that key was clean except for the evidence at the end. It was almost like it had been cleaned off and then, evidence was placed on it. Because it only had Avery's hands on it, right? So...
Correct. There was zero. There was no fingerprints or any trace evidence or DNA. That put that key in, and showed that Teresa Hallbeck had handled that. Or used that. In regular fashion and stuff like that. So again, it's more. It just seems like it's a common theme, Al, that the evidence that convicts Steve Avery at his original trial seems to an outside observer that really doesn't understand who these police officers are, and who these people are that are involved in prosecuting the case. It would seem that these are just a really strong pieces of evidence taken, one at a time. But then when you understand, the circumstances of...
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
No, they didn't just go into Avery's bedroom and find this key on the floor. But by the way, this was like the sixth or seventh time that they've been in there. You know, this is a little bedroom. It's only a few hundred square feet to begin with. You know, and again, the same way with the garage. They'd already been in there several times back when the case was fresh, when nothing, you know, when they're trying to find legitimate evidence and they search, you know, inside and out of the garage, you know, and don't find this evidence. And then all of a sudden they decide to go back at a later point in time. And it's almost like they knew, you know, and had this kind of all worked out that, that it was going to kind of turn out the way that it was gonna. And we see this on multiple occasions, throughout the case. It's just a theme of the case.
Now, throughout Making a Murderer 2, as time goes on, it's suggested that actually Brendan's new stepfather and brother had something to do with it, had something to do with the case itself. And what's your thoughts on that?
Well, again, this is a good opportunity to remind listeners that one of the most important pieces of evidence at the time of the original murder traced back to the Bobby Dassey household, and that was Teresa's bones. You know, they were found inside of the Dassey burn barrel. In the Dassey burn barrel, it was at least 50 or 60 yards, you know, away from the Stephen Avery property. That was their own separate unit on the premises. So again, you have Teresa Halbeck's bones being found inside the burn barrel of that was used by Bobby Dassey when he hunted and dismembered deer carcasses. So that's a key point right there that sometimes, you know, was either overlooked or underplayed, or maybe just kind of, really didn't, was an opportunity to go there during the first Making a Murderer series. But that's a key component right there. And then the other parts, though, are the fact that there was just some bizarre behavior by these guys at the time of the crime. Bobby's basically the only person in the world, you know, that puts himself in a situation where he is watching and observing, possibly stalking, you know, Teresa Halbeck, you know, around the time frame that she's going to meet her demise. He claims that he's, watching out of his window, and it's just an odd set of circumstances, and some of the, you know, computer forensics show that his testimony really doesn't match up with what he said on the stand about he just happened to look out the window and lo and behold, Teresa Halbeck showed up and he's watching her and then decides to go take a shower and then, you know, gets done with that shower and then goes off to go deer hunting. And lo and behold, there's only one person in the whole world that supposedly sees him on a 55-mile-an-hour state highway. You know, he's driving one way and the other person's going the other way. And it's Scott Halbeck, who's his future stepfather. So there's just all these bizarre, strange sets of circumstances. And why that's important for listeners to understand is that they basically were able to say, by claiming that they saw each other on State Highway 147 around 3 o'clock or so, they basically were able to alibi each other as far as around the time of the murder, even though there's no verification, nobody else, you know, in the world, you know, has come forward and said, oh yeah, I saw Scott or, you know, I saw Bobby, you know, driving 147. they were able to alibi each other by coming up with that strange, bizarre story. And the Zellners come up with on her own by doing research on Bobby Dassey's phone records. His cell phone calls bounce off of a different cell phone tower that would put him in an opposite direction, you know, from where he and Scott, or Scott and he, you know, claimed that they drove by each other, you know, and waved at each other around the time of Teresa's murder.
Yeah, and there was something about the location of where the future stepfather ended up buying and living as well.
Yeah, and I was actually out there this summer when I was I was up in Wisconsin. I had to take one of my kids up there for a camp this summer, and it gave me an opportunity then to spend some time back in Manitowoc County. I was able to spend several hours that day going out to areas that we're talking about here to get some additional photographs for the book, but also to kind of re-remind myself, since it had been probably almost a year, about a year, since I had last been out at, you know, Avery Salvage and also the surrounding terrain out there. But that area that Scott Todich ultimately, relocated, you know, and now lives, it's still very close, and he was living very close to an area where, several people have come forward, you know, on Zellner's behalf to give an affidavit insisting that they absolutely saw Teresa Halbach's RAV4 hidden off of Highway 147, kind of back behind what's known as the East Twin Bridge, the old dam property. It's a secluded little area that's just kind of right off the state highway there. And again, it wasn't very far from where Scott Todich was living at the time. And then it's also not very far from where he lives currently, where he has a house over in that area.
And her cell phone pinged as well in that area too, didn't it?
Correct. And that was one of the key points that Zellner came up with shortly after she took over the case, was really trying to get a handle on Teresa's consistent whereabouts. What was her routine and regularity as far as with her auto trader assignments? And from what Zellner was able to uncover as far as looking at the phone records and the cell phone tower pings, she was able to determine that in all likelihood, Teresa did leave Avery's property around 2:35 that Monday afternoon, which was Halloween, and left Avery Road, would have turned back onto 147, and you know, put her out somewhere in the general area, you know, of County Highway Q. And, you know, again, it's a very rural area for the most part, but you have a number of quarries, sand and gravel pits that are out in that same general area. And, again, that area was the cell phone tower pings that the Zellner was able to determine that came off of what is known as the White Law Tower. That's about 13 to 13.1 miles away, you know, from Avery Salvage property. And again, if Teresa was really killed and harmed, you know, at the Avery, on Avery Road around 2:30 or so, it really kind of defies logic that somehow, you know, within a few minutes of that, you know, the time that she was supposedly killed over there, that her phone is going to be pinging off of a cell tower that's really about 13 miles away from the Avery property.
You know, another thing, when you were out there, did you have a chance to check out where a lot of when the dogs were out searching the Avery property, they also searched a lot of the property of the neighbors as well as what belongs to the county. And some of the bones were found in those areas. Were you able to check out that area yourself?
Yes and no. Yes, from the standpoint of that I went out to those areas, and I've been out in those areas before, know from the standpoint that it's really private property as far as it's county-owned property, you know, and you know, arguably I would be trespassing if I went out there. It's changed a little bit, too, from back in the day. I mean, it's still a quarry, per se. But the thing is, the county has they've worked something out with the business. There's a bunch of, I'm going off of memory here now, but I think it's windmill parts, that are just kind of stored and stacked throughout the property. Whereas back in 05, you know, when the crime happened, it was, you know, just really open, wide open space out there as far as the gravel pit. But nowadays, there's a lot of, these windmill parts that are being stored, you know, throughout the property and stuff like that, which would make it difficult to, you know, go to and stuff like that. But along those lines too, though, I did go out to Cuss Road, you know, and that's kind of in that general area over by the Redant, sand and gravel pit, as well. So again, I did spend some time, and I've been out there several times before to kind of get a visual understanding of the area where, you know, again, where are the dogs? You know, not this is just my speculation or anybody else's speculation, but these were some of the best trained dogs in all of the state of Wisconsin, and they were brought into the case to try to find Teresa Halbach. They used her shoes, so the soles of her shoes, you know, as a scent. And lo and behold, these dogs were repeatedly finding you know, sense of Teresa Halbach, not by Stephen Avery's, you know, red trailer, but far away, about a half a mile away, and in some of the other areas that were closer to the Redant quarry, which again points to the strong possibility here that that Teresa met her end somewhere, you know, far, far away from the Stephen Avery trailer or the red garage. You know, which is where Mr. Kratz and the Manitowoc County Sheriff's Office, you know, had come up with the theory that that's where the crime had happened.
So now a lot of the bones that they found off Avery's property, like in the zones where the dogs were looking, a lot of them were human as well, weren't they?
Correct. And that was really downplayed and really just kind of kept hush hush as far as at the time of the original trial. And I think even Dean Strang and Jerry Buting really didn't have a, you know, perfect grasp as far as all these other bones. A lot of these things were really labeled in a kind of a sneaky fashion. They were basically labeled by their geographic, quadrants. Zellner was smart enough and intelligent enough to kind of get her staff to really, drill down these locations, and she was able to determine that that not only were the infamous pelvic bones that were found out in the quarry existing, and again the pelvic bones at the time of Avery's trial were portrayed as you know, maybe not even being human, and the state really to this day has never definitively had those analyzed to the point of you know, proving for sure that they are Teresa Halbach's, in all likelihood they are. But again, you didn't just have though these pelvic bones, as Zellner was able to determine, and comes out in the second Making Murders series. But you had, yeah, two additional piles of bones, human bones, that were found in completely different areas of the Manitowoc County quarry. So in total here, there were three sets of locations inside the Manitowoc County quarry that had, you know, human bones, you know, that are probably those of Teresa Halbach.
And that was also described on the Making a Murderer 2 as an area that the RAV4 could have been driven up into the back of Avery's property.
Right. I think that that was portrayed as, again, at that point in time, it would be easy to, you know, kind of drive through some of those you know, those fields and what they call conveyor roads out there. They're really kind of primitive, terrain and stuff like that. But a vehicle could easily, get through there, without much problem and stuff. You wouldn't be able to drive a semi-trailer, for example, out there. But a car or an SUV, a smaller SUV, really wouldn't have that much trouble driving through there, Al.
So now that we're at this place, it doesn't look real good for the Brandon Dassey case being not heard by the Supreme Court. So I'm not sure if that can go much further unless the Steve Avery case does. Where do you see the Steve Avery case going now?
Well, I think in the next few weeks or so, Kathleen Zellner will be filing her post-conviction material, her appeal, with the Wisconsin Court of Appeals. And I think from there it'll be up to them to determine, whether or not she's presented enough material to allow for what's commonly called an evidentiary hearing. And if she gets an evidentiary hearing, I feel that she's probably going to be in real good shape as far as to be able to blow up and destroy, the prosecution's case against Steve Avery. She's been very successful in a lot of her cases around the country, Al, with once she gets an opportunity to have a bona fide evidentiary hearing, which is kind of like a trial, except it's, not a full-blown, original trial, but it's like a trial where she could call witnesses and put on evidence. And, it's ultimately back in front of a judge to make the determination as far as, whether a new trial should be granted or not. And again, if she was successful, there's probably a real good chance that the state of Wisconsin would walk away from the case and not retry Avery again, if she was successful as far as getting a new trial. But again, right now it'll be up to the Wisconsin Court of Appeals. I don't want to get too far down the road because frankly, I'm, kind of not sure where things would go from there. But in all likelihood though, the judge that was handling the case over the last year or so, who really is, regarded as kind of a, weak link, she's not really a top judge, and that's Angela Sukowitz. She's probably completely done with the case at this point in time, because she already was kind of overruled once before this year, earlier this year in 2018, when the Court of Appeals had sent the case back to her regarding some of this evidence that was being apparently hidden from Dean Strang and Jerry Buting the first time around. That's the computer computer disk from the Dassey computer, from the Bobby Dassey computer. So again, if Zellner is successful at the Court of Appeals level, Al, she's going to probably then ask for a different judge to be appointed to the case, probably somebody from the Manitowoc County Courthouse, because there really is no reason for Sheboygan County, the neighboring county, to be in charge of the case anymore. And we'll see if that materializes. But I would just advise people to pay attention to the case, around Christmas time, because that's when Zellner will make her filing. And then early over the next couple months too, we'll have some changes in leadership in the state of Wisconsin. There's a new governor coming in, and there's also a new attorney general. And the current attorney general was really played a big role in keeping Brandon Dassey locked up, and he kept doing all those appeals, which for him turned out to be successful. But most people really believed that Brandon Dassey had nothing to do with the crime. It seemed like a big injustice that Brad Schimmel, was continuing to just kind of almost seemed like he was just kind of reading from a script. I mean, he just really seemed like he doesn't really know the case inside and out, but was just kind of playing politics. But now he's done. He's over and done with, the state of Wisconsin. The voters kicked him out of office. So there's a new opportunity to see where the case is going to go with different people in charge of the Wisconsin Attorney General's office right now.
So if the case all falls apart and Mr. Avery gets released, Where do you think it goes from there? Do you see lawsuits for Avery? Do you see people suing for money for Avery for wrongful, imprisonment again, like the first one? Do you see all that happening?
Yeah, I mean that's generally kind of the script that that plays out in a lot of these cases around the country, and that was true with Kathleen Zellner and her her handling of the Riot Ferguson case in Columbia, Missouri. It took she was able to get him freed a number of years ago, I think about 4 or 5 years ago, but it was only I think in the past year or so that we're able to reach a multi-million-dollar settlement. So, again, I think that those are all probabilities. It would be I just don't see a situation, where Avery's let out of prison, let's just say, next summer, for example, the summer of 19, and that he moves to Michigan, for example, and kind of walks away from the case and, doesn't want, or doesn't pursue, any type of financial compensation for, the injustice that would have occurred to him as far as losing the last, 11, 12 years of his life for being, wrongly convicted of this crime, as he's maintained. So again, those things are still unsettled, and really, we'll kind of see where things go from here. I mean, I'm still sure that it'll be interesting to see how the Court of Appeals handles Zellner. Because again, the first judge, this most recent judge that was on the case, really didn't even give her the time of day as far as didn't even allow an evidentiary hearing, even though she's put together some very compelling evidence as far as allegations of Brady violations, which again are allegations that are pretty damning and usually are responsible for getting a conviction overturned. And that's Brady violation is when the prosecution or the police are suspected of intentionally concealing evidence that's favorable to the defendant at the time of his or her trial. And she's found several examples of that.
Yeah, just amazing. Well, it's been an interesting hour. Again, really good work. You're a good writer, and this is an excellent book, and we'll have it linked on our page as well. And do you have any contact information for people if they have any information to you, or what's the best way to get a hold of you?
I would say the best way for a lot of people to reach me, again, if they're on social media, they can usually follow me on just John, J-O-H-N, Farrak, F-E-R-A-K, on Twitter. The other thing is I have my own website, True Crime Author website, and that's just my first and last name, so John, F-E-R-A-K.com. Those are usually the two best ways for folks to reach out to me. And again, with Wrecking Crew, the book's available in all formats. There's a paperback version, and there's a Kindle version, and as of right now, there should be an audio version, an Audible version that should be showing up on Amazon any second now or any day now. I've been constantly checking to see because I have had a lot of people around the country, actually around the world, have constantly been asking me, is this coming out in an audiobook?
Yeah,
format as well. So
people like that.
Those are very popular nowadays. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
But again, just the easiest way to find the book, frankly, is do Google search for Wrecking Crew and John Farrak or Kathleen Zellner and Wrecking Crew and just find it on Amazon.
Well, again, thank you very much. John Farrak's our guest, and Wrecking Crew is what we're talking about. Making a Murderer Part 2. Thank you.
Thanks for the opportunity to be on the show again, Al. Have a great day.
To find out more about our show, guests, or to listen to past shows from our archive, please go to www.houseofmysteryradio.com.
Show's over for now. Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.